A Twist of Sin, written by R.J. Jagger, narrated by Barry Campbell. 1. May 11, Monday evening. The Mediterranean Sea was choppy and the Egyptian night was black. Kinjo pounded through the waves in a 20-foot inflatable dinghy called Lil Misfit. A stiff wind threw spray into the air every time the vessel crashed down on a wave. Kinjo was soaked, but was too busy keeping the bow pointed toward the black shoreline to care. In the middle of the dinghy, securely strapped down, was a waterproof case. Inside that case was money. A lot of money. U.S. currency. From the mothership, Misfit, it took a full 30 minutes to reach shore, which was a desolate, rocky beach between Baltim and Damietta, Egypt. It took another 3 minutes to drag the vessel far enough up to where the waves couldn't grab it. There. So far, so good. He pulled the case out of the boat, carried it 100 meters up the shore, and stashed it in the rocks. He went back to the boat, walked a kilometer in the opposite direction along the shore, and cut south for 300 meters until he came to the road. Then he called Rafik and spoke in English. I'm here. You're late. Kinjo ignored it, gave him the coordinates, and said, Be sure you come alone. I don't want anyone in the mix that I don't already know. You got the money? Of course I have the money, Kinjo said. He almost hung up, but added, If there's anything weird going on in your life, if there's any reason why this isn't going to go exactly the way it's supposed to go, this is the time to tell me. Silence. Then Rafik said, You worry too much. I'll see you soon. Kinjo hung up, sat on a rock for a few heartbeats, then stood up and paced. At 5'9", 150 pounds, he wasn't big, but that didn't mean he wasn't intimidating. Every pound of his 28-year-old Tokyo body was taut, compressed, and fast. His stomach was concrete. His chest was strong enough to do push-ups until dawn, and his hands could snatch flies out of the air. He had a rough, bad boy face. He wore his hair long, 8 inches past his shoulders, sometimes loose and free, but usually, like now, hanging in dreadlocks. He had 2 tattoos, one on his right chest and one on his right arm, both black tribal markings. His left ear was pierced, and so was his left nipple. Several pieces of bling hung around his neck, together with a cross. The Egyptian air was hot. Kinjo was almost dry when he first spotted headlights in the distance. 2 minutes later, Rafik pulled up in an older model Honda sedan, alone. He looked a couple of years older than the last time Kinjo saw him, but otherwise about the same. Darkly handsome, bushy eyebrows, short black hair, and a muscular body. He wore beige cotton pants and a white long-sleeve shirt. It's been a long time, Kinjo said.
3 years, my friend. 3 years.
The man turned the car around, pointed the front end towards Cairo, and said,
I'm still a little shocked that you had the high bid. I had no idea that you had such good clients.
Well, now you know.
Still, I'm impressed. I almost didn't even call you for a bid. It was a last-minute fluke, to tell you the truth, Rafik said. And now here you are, sitting in my car, such as it is. So who is this mystery client of yours, anyway?
Kinjo cocked his head. Someone who trusts me, he said.
Rafik laughed. Then you're one up on me, he said. So good for you.
1.5 hours later, they pulled up to a small metal warehouse in a raggedy industrial area on the south edge of Cairo. Rafik unlocked a metal door, stepped inside, turned on a flashlight, and relocked the door behind them. The building had no windows. The interior was as black as an underground cave.
Sorry, no electricity, he said.
With the flashlight as their guide, they walked across a dirt floor to a stack of wooden pallets. Next to the pallets, lying in the dirt, was a crude ladder made of 2x4s and nails. Rafik picked it up, carried it across the floor, and leaned it upright against the side of the building. Then he climbed. Kinjo followed. They ended up in a wooden storage area 3 or 4 meters off the floor. The front area was cluttered with junk. Behind it, Rafik pulled a tarp away to reveal a wooden box the size of a coffin. He grabbed a bar next to it and pried the top off. Inside was a sturdy plastic box. He lifted it out, opened the top, and handed the flashlight to Kinjo. Inside were 2 carefully packaged 18th Dynasty gilded cartonnage masks from the tomb of Thuya and Yuya, who were the parents of Queen Taye, who in turn was the grandmother of Tutankhamun. The masks, initially discovered in the Valley of the Kings in 1905, recently disappeared without a trace from the Egyptian Museum in Cairo. Kinjo studied them carefully and found them to be genuine. "I'm impressed," he said.
"You are satisfied?"
"I am."
"They're the real thing," Rafik said. "You don't need to worry about that."
"I can tell," Kinjo said. "How the hell did you pull it off? That's what I want to know."
Rafik slapped him on the back. "That's for me to know and for you to not know," he said. "Tell your buyer there will be more interesting things for sale down the road."
"I'll do that."
Back at the shore, Rafik counted the money and said, "There's more here than we agreed on. 250,000 more, if I'm counting it right."
"That's my profit from the client," Kinjo said. "I want you to take it with you and wire it to me in Tokyo."
Rafik raised an eyebrow. "You trust me to do that?"
Kinjo nodded.
"Then you're crazier than I thought," Rafik said. "You must not have a very good client if you think he's going to kill you just because you're carrying a little of your own money around."
"If I thought he'd do that, I wouldn't be here right now," Kinjo said. "But he's anchored 30 minutes out to sea, waiting for the delivery as we speak. That means that very soon he's going to have what he's been waiting for. Sometimes after people get what they want, they get greedy. And sometimes other people vanish at sea." He slapped Rafik on the back and said, "I don't see a reason to tempt him, do you? I'll call you tomorrow with the account information."
"You do that."
They got the masks securely strapped into the boat and then dragged it to the water's edge. Rafik set the case of money on the ground and hugged Kinjo goodbye. Before they pulled apart, a terrible sound erupted from not more than 50 meters away, the sound of a high-powered rifle. Rafik's head exploded. Brains and blood splattered onto Kinjo's face. Rafik's body went limp in his arms. Just as the man hit the ground, the rifle fired again. Rafik's body jerked violently. The bullet passed through him and shattered the case of money. There was no time to get the boat into the water. Kinjo grabbed a handful of loose bills, ran into the sea, and dived into the first wave. A bullet flew past his head, then another, and another. 2. Day 1, May 15, Friday evening. Neva Narateja landed in Jamaica just as darkness settled over the Caribbean and the lights of Montego Bay started to twinkle. A heavy rain fell out of a dark sky and pounded against the aircraft. She didn't care and smiled easily, partly because of the 2 rum and cokes in her gut, but mostly because she just survived her first full year at NYU School of Law. The big trick now was to make some money this summer. Money, money, money. She wore tennis shoes and a plain black tee tucked into loose jeans. Her hair was pulled back and she wore no makeup. To the casual eye, she was just one more mildly attractive black woman in her early 20s. Nice enough, but not over-the-top gorgeous by any means. A closer look, however, would show that the first look was wrong. It would show that her light brown Jamaican skin was flawless, her eyes were hypnotic green, and her pitch-black hair was straight, thick, and healthy. A third look would show that even the second look was wrong. It would show that, in fact, there was something mysteriously compelling about her face. Not obvious, not blatant, but addictive. It was the kind of exotic island face that sailors killed for once they realized it was there.
The summer would be a good one, and she was more than ready for it, starting right now, this second. She'd hit the clubs tonight with Brianna, jog on the beach for a week, and then get her ass back into the world of high fashion and modeling. Her agent, the lovely Miss Renee, had already booked her with good-paying gigs that would keep her running around the globe until classes started again in the fall. In 10 days, she'd be in Paris to do runway work, then Rome for a major fashion shoot, followed by Prague for TV commercials. Under her clothes was a taut body, equally at home in a bikini, high heels, or the most outrageous and wildest fashion. Her stomach was flat, her ass was round, and her thighs could crank out a 100-meter dash in 11.2 seconds. Her lungs were good, too. When she snorkeled the reefs, no one could stay under longer, not even the guys. Brianna wasn't waiting for her in the terminal, even though she was supposed to be, and even though Neva had specifically called her just last night to remind her. Brianna, Brianna, Brianna. A good roommate, a good friend, ever since third grade, in fact, but a first-class scatterbrain. Neva dialed her number. No one answered.
God, you are so undependable.
She waited for a half hour before giving up and muscling 2 oversized suitcases through the concourse to a cab. Behind the wheel was a small, wiry man in his 50s, smoking and bobbing his head to a Bob Marley song, not overly interested in getting into the rain to help her. The interior smelled like a forest fire that someone had tried to douse with a hose. Neva threw the suitcases into the back seat, got into the front, gave him directions, and added,
"I've been in New York for the last 8 months. Do you know what sucks about New York?"
No, he didn't.
"The smog?"
"No."
"The traffic?"
"No," she said. "The thing that sucks about New York is that it has no weed, man. No weed at all. I need to get Jamaica back in my blood, if you catch my drift."
"Consider your drift caught," he said.
"I know some places if you don't."
The man laughed.
"Good one," he said.
10 minutes later, he pulled up to the back door of a bar called the Typhoon Baboon, left the engine running and the wipers on, and disappeared inside with $100 of Neva's money. 60 seconds later, he got back in, shook water out of his hair, and tossed a baggie into her lap.
"Enjoy, pretty lady."
She examined the bag to be sure it was a fair amount. It was.
"Can I smoke in here?"
"That depends."
"On what?"
"On whether you're going to share."
She laughed.
"I said I was in New York," she said. "I didn't say New York was in me. You got papers?"
He did. She rolled a joint, extra thick. They smoked it as the headlights punched through an ever-increasing storm. 30 minutes later, the cabbie dropped her off at a small, desolate bungalow perched on a sandy bluff on the south edge of the island. It was Neva's home, inherited from her mother. The windows were black. No lights came from inside. Weird. Where was Brianna? At the airport? A stiff wind blew the weather into her face. Beyond the house, at the base of the bluff, waves lapped violently against the beach. She picked up the suitcases and scooted to the front door as fast as she could. One last look at the cab showed the taillights already disappearing. She tried the knob. It didn't turn. She knocked.
"Come on, Brianna!"
No one answered. She fumbled around in her purse until she found her keys, then opened the door and stepped inside. The house was pitch black, except for a few small green lights on the CD player across the room. A Sean Paul song, Temperature, came from the speakers over by the window. She flipped the light switch on. The interior lit up. What she saw made her stop breathing. The place was trashed. Everything was on the floor, violently smashed. The furniture was overturned. It was almost as if someone had broken in and searched for something small, leaving no crack or crevice untouched. She held her breath and listened for sounds. She heard nothing other than Sean Paul.
"Brianna?"
No answer.
"Brianna, are you here?"
No answer. Nothing. Her instinct was to turn and run, get somewhere safe, and call the police. But she couldn't, not without knowing if Brianna was safe.
She walked toward the woman's room, one step at a time, ready to turn and bolt for even the slightest reason. She heard nothing, not a sound, not a peep. The door to Brianna's room was closed. Neva put her hand on the knob, turned it, slowly pushed the door open and listened. The hinges squeaked. The room was dark and coffin quiet.
"Brianna, are you in here?"
No one answered. Suddenly, Neva's cell phone rang. The sound froze her. She answered and a woman's voice came through. "Is this Neva Narateja?" The words were in English, but with a thick Spanish overlay.
"Yes, who's this?"
"Good, I got you," the woman said. "My name is Rio Costa. I'm from Brazil. You don't know me, and I know this is going to sound strange, but I think we're related. I think we are both descendants of a man named Antonio Valente. I need to talk to you about something very important. I'd like to do that tonight, if possible. I'm in Jamaica right now. My plane just landed. If it's okay with you, I was hoping we could meet somewhere."
Neva almost answered, but flicked the light switch on instead. Brianna was on the bed, not moving. Her hands were tied behind her back. Her ankles were tied. There was some kind of a gag in her mouth. Her eyes were frozen open, staring at nothing, and there was blood, lots of blood. Suddenly, lightning flashed, followed immediately by a deafening clap of thunder. The room shook and the phone dropped out of Neva's hand. She left it where it was and headed for the body. She needed to close Brianna's eyelids. It was wrong that they were still open, so terribly wrong.
3. Day 1, May 15, Friday night. Friday night after dark, Nick Teffinger, the 34-year-old head of Denver's homicide unit, had his garage door open. Inside that garage was a red, matching numbers, 1967 Corvette with the hood pointed toward the street and the top down. Teffinger sat behind the wheel, drinking his second Bud Light and watching a violent thunderstorm rip the night apart. He had the seat pushed back to give his 6'2" frame room to stretch. In his shirt pocket was a photograph of Paige Lake. She didn't die pretty. Someone stripped her naked, tied her spread-eagle to a bed, and cut the head off a live chicken above her. After she was covered in blood, he played with her nipples and all the other lovely parts. Then he slit her throat. That was 2 years ago. She was 29 at the time, a schoolteacher. She had no enemies. She had no lovers. Now she was just one more cold case in a stack of cold cases. Teffinger's cell phone rang, and the voice of Sydney Heatherwood came through.
"Nick, are you okay?" she asked.
He hesitated.
"Yeah, why wouldn't I be?"
"You were weird all day," she said. "Something's wrong."
"No, nothing's wrong."
"I know when something's wrong," she said. "I'm coming over."
"Don't you dare."
20 minutes later, she showed up, found him in the garage, got a glass of wine from the kitchen, and slipped into the passenger seat. She was 27, African-American, athletic, and a natural-born hunter. Although she was still the newbie of the homicide unit, she had already cut her teeth on Denver's worst.
"Are you going to tell me what's wrong, or am I going to have to pry it out of you?"
He handed her the picture of Paige Lake.
"You want to hear a stupid story?"
"Why? Do you have some other kind?"
He smiled, then got serious. "The lady you're looking at is Paige Lake," he said. "She got killed just short of 2 years ago. I handled the case personally and never got close to solving it."
"Yeah, well, join the club," Sydney said.
"No, no, this isn't a pity party," Teffinger said. "Here's the thing. 7 months or so after she died, I got an email out of the blue. It said, 'Where? Johannesburg. When? Next week.' That's all it said. I had no idea what it meant or who sent it, but it was weird enough that I contacted the Johannesburg authorities and let them know about it. They called 5 days later
and let us know that a woman by the name of Jewel Brand had been murdered. The same way as Page Lake? Teffinger shook his head. No, not the same way, not with chicken blood or anything like that, but it was with the same intensity, he said. There was no question in my mind that the person who sent me the email was the same person who killed Page Lake. Sidney took a sip of wine and studied him. So what'd you do? We sent Johannesburg our file, they sent us theirs, and we had lots of telephone calls, mostly handled by Katie Baxter, he said. In the end, none of it did any good. Sidney frowned. How about the email itself? She asked. Did you try to trace it? Teffinger nodded. The best we could get was that it originated somewhere in Athens, but even that we're not sure of. The geeks say there are ways to relay things, to make them look like they came from somewhere where they really didn't. Or he might have just contacted someone in Athens and paid them to send it. Who knows? As for the email address, it was just one of those internet freebies that someone opened using bogus information. Sidney scratched her head. So why is this so much on your mind all of a sudden? Because I got another email today, he said. It was the exact same as Johannesburg, except Johannesburg is Tokyo this time. Lightning arced across the sky. Thunder rolled over Denver. Teffinger drank the last swallow of beer, crushed the can in his fist, and dropped it out the window onto the garage floor. Then he reached into the back seat and pulled a fresh one out of a cooler, ice cold, dangerously good. So what you're saying, if I'm getting you right, is that the guy who killed our woman here in Denver, Page Lake, right, Page Lake, that guy is going to kill someone in Tokyo. Teffinger nodded. There you go. Next week, to be precise. Sidney took a long swallow of wine, then looked at him and said, So what are you going to do? Teffinger groaned. Nothing, if you ask the chief, he said. I had a long talk with him this afternoon. He doesn't have the budget to send me on a 10,000-mile field trip if there's no realistic possibility that something good will come of it. Sidney contemplated it. I hate to say it, she said, but he's actually right. There's no way you can stop this guy. About the best you could do is help Tokyo mop up after the fact. Teffinger shrugged. That's what I thought at first, he said. What does that mean? It means that you're right, he said. How could I possibly find someone in a foreign city of 10 million people? I kept thinking about it all day and couldn't figure it out. But then, after I unwound a bit and had a Bud Light, it came to me. What came to you? He patted her on the hand. The obvious. She thought about it, then punched him in the arm. Damn it, Nick, stop being you for a few minutes. He combed his hair back with his fingers. Here's what I figured out, he said. The only possible way I could find him is if he finds me. So I sent a reply to his email and said I would come, but only if he promises to kill me. Sidney sat there, stunned, saying nothing. Teffinger took a swallow of beer and watched the storm. Then Sidney asked, So what did he say? Teffinger shrugged. I don't know. I haven't checked my messages yet.